For tonight's program, I'm especially grateful to Argonne National Laboratory and the Argonne Out Loud Public Lecture Series, the Office of the Vice President for Research and for National Laboratories, and to the University of Chicago Alumni Association for inviting us to partner with them on this program. On behalf of the University of Chicago and the global International House community, I want to thank you all for coming tonight. And now I'd like to welcome to the stage tonight's host, Tracy Quinn. Tracy is Associate Vice President for National Laboratories in the University's Office of the Vice President for Research and for National Laboratories. In her role, Tracy serves as Secretary to the UChicago Argonne Board of Governors and the Fermi Research Alliance, the Board of Directors, and has executive management responsibility for support, programmatic, and operational review functions for both boards. We're very pleased to have Tracy here tonight to introduce tonight's speaker. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you, Denise. So, we had smooth jazz playing before we all sat down. It's a cool night. Summer is right around the bend. It's definitely a night for a love story. And a love story is what we'll get tonight, albeit a highly non-traditional love story. But every love story has two requirements. First, a fantastic setting. And second, a phenomenal narrator. And we have both this evening. First, the setting. It does, in fact, take place in an extraordinary location, a place about 25 miles to the west of here, in the middle of the prairie, at a place called Argonne National Laboratory, a place where science is being pushed to the boundaries, where the greatest global questions are being addressed. And our narrator hails from that great place. Our narrator, in fact, is beautiful and wonderful, Dr. Jack Gilbert. And I have to be very careful in terms of how I describe his credentials because he is so credentialed. He's the associate professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago and a preeminent environmental microbiologist at Argonne National Laboratory. He also holds an appointment at Marine Biology Laboratory. Both Argonne National Laboratory and Marine Biology Lab are critical to the University of Chicago and, in fact, are critical to all of us as we look at what science can do. After you hear Jack share his love story tonight, I think you will agree with me that he is truly a microbial rock star. So, our scene has been set. We know we have a great narrator to share the story. And so let's now take a sneak peek at the love story to come. Please roll video.
It's not going to be as smooth as we hope. Sorry. While we wait for the computer to play,
I'm Dr. Jack Gilbert, and you're covered in bacteria.
Welcome to Chicago. There are 10 million people in the metropolitan area, and every single one of those people is shedding from their bodies 15 million microbial cells an hour. That means that every time you interact with someone in your day-to-day life, you're picking up microbial signatures from them. And that's shaping your microbiome and altering your life. And that's fundamental to our research, trying to understand that interaction, map it, structure it, and use it to understand health dynamics. So for the last 100 to 150 years, we've been trying to wipe out all microbes in our environment. With antibiotics and sterilization agents, we've been going at them hammer and tongs, trying to kill them all. And we're now starting to realize that those microbes are really important for our ecosystem and our health. They train our immune system to be strong and healthy. We need them in our environment. So you have 100 trillion bacterial cells inside your body. They outnumber your own cells 10 to 1. And what we're starting to understand is by looking at those organisms and finding out which ones you have versus which ones your friends have, we can say intricate things about your health and your well-being. For the last 10 years or so, we've been applying next-generation sequencing technologies like those we have at Argonne National Laboratory, which are like telescopes helping us to see the microbial world inside our bodies and our environments in unprecedented detail. And we're starting to learn things about the microbial interaction we share with our environments. Our homes, our offices, our cities shape our microbial cells, and that in turn shapes our health. By looking at these things in detail, we're finding out that bacteria can maybe, if we change the ones inside you, cure things like autism, Alzheimer's, even cancers. We can look at obesity as an epidemic. We can understand neurological conditions like schizophrenia and reshape them. Allergies, asthma, they can be eradicated by adding the right kinds of bacteria back in. So it's fundamental that we understand this in a rich and cohesive way.
Without further ado, let me introduce you, Dr. Jack Gilbert. Jack?
And I have a very loud, oh my God, voice. I also like Twitter, so I'm going to get a picture of you guys on Twitter. There we are. And make sure that the world can see that people are listening to me out there somewhere. Okay, so my gambit is bacteria. I fundamentally think bacteria are the most awesome thing on the planet. They are the most pervasive thing, for sure. They are found everywhere. Every single one of you, as that video so eloquently described, has around 100 trillion bacterial cells inside your body. That's around 3 pounds of your body mass. So most of that weight is embedded in your intestine, right? And there's around 99.9 trillion of them are living inside there. The rest of them are all over your skin, they're in your nose, they're in your mouth, they're in your urogenital tract, they're in your hair. They are literally crawling all over you. And they're not just crawling all over you, they're emanating from pretty much every part of your body. And I can see people feeling a little bit creeped out by that. But you shouldn't be. Without them, you'd be dead. And as long as you value your life, you should probably be grateful that they're there. Hopefully I'll explain what I mean by that concept and why I think they're important. But I also want you to get a grasp of how dynamic your interaction is with the world. You know, you aren't just an organism living inside your clothing, sitting inside a room. You're actually an integrated and interacting organism of people, all living together and communicating in ways you never thought you were before. So hopefully you'll get that impression, right? So this is your microbial body. Your microbial body is very important. It's not just human organs and human cells in there. There's around 20 to 30 trillion human cells. That's a lot of cells, right? There's only 7 billion people on the planet. So this is orders of magnitude more cells in your body than there are people living on the planet. And they are very dense, those human cells, so they weigh a lot. The bacterial cells, mostly found in your intestine here, are very light. They're very, very tiny. They're less than a micron in size. But they're very, very important. And they're so numerous that they weigh the same as your brain, right? The number of bacteria in your body weighs the same as your brain weighs. And if you think your brain's important, then you probably make the conclusion that bacteria are important as well. And they fundamentally interact with us, and they can't help but interact with us. They're not doing it for their own benefit. They're just doing it because they're life forms that have evolved to, when they land somewhere, when they find a niche, they just deal with it, right? And if the environment they find themselves in is good and it's healthy and it enables them to reproduce, they will reproduce. So when they land on you, they find a nice, warm environment with lots of nutrients, and they start growing and they multiply. And I'll explain where they come from in as we go forward. But this is a vitally important part. Now we need them. We need them so desperately. You as a kingdom of life, the eukaryota, right? There are three kingdoms of life. There are bacteria, there are archaea, and there are eukaryotes. Every single thing you can see with your eye is in the eukaryote kingdom. The bacteria in the archaea are invisible to our eye. They are microscopic single-cellular life forms. The bacteria in archaea look identical under a microscope. They just look like bacterial cells, right? Exactly the same thing as you saw in grade school. Just a single cell sitting there. But they are fundamentally different at the metabolic level. I'm not going to go into too much detail. That's for first year bio class. But this is a mouse. And if we take all the bacteria away from that mouse, we generate what we call a germ-free mouse. Literally germ because it has no bacteria associated with it. Then it starts to grow funny. Right? Its organs don't develop properly. Its brain doesn't develop properly. This is a mouse intestine. The one on the far right is a healthy mouse intestine called a cecum. The one on the far left is the cecum from a germ-free mouse. You grow a mouse up without bacteria, its intestines inflame. The immune system that you'd normally associate with an inflammatory reaction due to an infection, you know, my nose is all inflamed or I've got a wound and it's gone all red and pussy, the same kind of immune response happens in the absence of bacteria, but it's overactive. There's no feedback mechanism to stop it, so it just gets out of control. And the organs inside the body, because they don't have any of that control, they just go crazy. The brain develops funnily as well. And we can see this. The normal response for a mouse is to stay hidden. Stay away from the predators. Stay quiet. Be meek. Be nervous, right? Always be aware that you could be eaten at any second. Okay? If you take all the bacteria away from a mouse, that germ-free mouse we saw earlier, a germ-free mouse will run out of that box along this platform, looking around, and sometimes hurl itself off of the end in some kind of psychotic suicidal risk factor. It just goes crazy, right? A mouse full of bacteria stays inside the box, meek, anxious, and perfectly happy. Why does it do this? Well, bacteria inside the mouse's intestine are interacting with its brain. It's releasing, there are two ways it does this. One, it interacts with your immune system, okay? So the bacteria living inside your intestine interact with the immune system of the gut, and they send signals up the nerve impulses through our spine and into our brain. When it gets into your brain, it releases chemicals which interact with your neurons and change your behavior. That's one. Two, the bacteria in your gut actually send chemical signals out into the gut matrix, which are picked up, put into the bloodstream, and they can also sometimes interact with the brain. There's something called the blood-brain barrier, but some very small molecules can pass across the blood-brain barrier. Microbes can't, but some bacterial metabolites can. And we see this in Alzheimer's and in Parkinson's, that the main trigger factors appear to be correlated to bacterial-produced metabolites. Now, so this we call the gut-brain axis. The bacteria living inside the intestine of this mouse are influencing its behavior, right? And it's doing the same to you. The bacteria living inside your intestine may be influencing your choices in subtle ways that you might not realize. You know, do you really want that hamburger for lunch, or is the salad better? Well, maybe your microbes really want the carbohydrates in the hamburger and all the nice fatty foods, and they really want them, so they subtly change your behavior. Not in any kind of controlling way, but just because they're altering their ecosystem. They're fundamentally changing their ecosystem to benefit them. And you are their ecosystem, right? This is interesting, but it's also vital. If we take all the microbes away from an animal, it doesn't develop properly. Its brain and its immune system in the gut develop very wrong. They don't work properly. They are broken in a fundamental way. And those brain impulses actually aren't functioning properly in the mouse. And this causes all kinds of problems. But we know that bacteria can be used to alter allergies. I said they interact with our immune system. Well, of course they do, right? But in this study, pioneering work with groups here at University of Chicago and Argonne National Laboratory, we've worked with mice which have a severe peanut allergy. If anyone's like against animal testing, it's amazing what we do to mice. It's pretty severely bad. We do a lot to them in the name of science. I say this as a biologist, but we created a mouse here, which if you give it peanuts, dies. It dies of a severe immune allergic reaction to peanuts. That's pretty nasty. But if we didn't do that, we'd have to test on children. And there are children in the audience, I'm hoping. Yeah? You can sign up later, man. It'll be cool. Just the guy at the back there with the swabs, Jared. Jared will, we'll give you some peanuts. We'll see what happens. That'd be cool. Or we could do it with these mice. So what we do is we take these mice that are severely allergic to peanuts and we give them peanuts and they die. If we add certain bacteria back into the gut of these mice, so-called clostridial organisms or clostridia, we add these bacteria back into the mouse doesn't have a severe allergic reaction to the peanuts. One bacteria added back into the intestine of this gut seems to cure it of an allergic response. How does that work? Well, these bacteria produce compounds. We call them short-chain fatty acids. One of them is called butyrate. And this butyrate actually is a food for some of the immune cells in the intestinal lining of the gut. And when those immune cells are sated by this food, they feed back upon the immune system and suppress it, stopping it from overreacting. This is important. The immune system that you've probably been told your entire lives is there to help protect us from pathogens and bacteria in the environment has actually evolved to interact with bacteria. Bacteria produce a metabolite, which is essential, a chemical, which is essential to curing the immune system's overactive response. And this is fascinating to me. So what happens is you give these mice back a clostridial organism, and when the immune system starts to over-respond to the peanut allergen, it feeds back, because this bacteria is producing all this butyrate, it feeds back on the immune system and suppresses the inflammatory response, allowing it to have a normal response to the allergen. And this is potentially a new form of therapy, a way of actually providing children who have an inappropriate immune response a mechanism by which they can live a normal life. We know that bacteria can change the way you sense wine. Now, this is a weird one, right? So I spent some time working down in Naples in Italy, and wine is really cheap there. So I was looking for a research project, and I thought, you know, wine's really cheap. Do a research project with wine. So we got what we did is we got 10 obese Italian men and 10 lean Italian men, and we got them to spit into jars. This is proper science, trust me. Got to spit into jars, and then we added wine to all the jars, and we stuck a spectral analyzer over the top that enables us to detect the kinds of chemical signatures which are being released from the digesting wine with saliva. Okay, so you've got this big wine-saliva mix, and it's releasing aromatic compounds, volatile metabolites, which are released into the air and picked up by my detector. What we showed was that if we mixed wine with the saliva of obese Italian men, there were fewer volatile compounds released. And we trace this back to the fact that in the lean Italian men's saliva, they have bacteria which are actively degrading the wine. They're actually degrading the wine and releasing all these volatile metabolites, which actually get up into the nasopharynx region and overstimulate our sensory system, right? They overstimulate the sensory system while you're drinking the wine. And what you get is a satiated response. So you actually don't feel like you want to drink much more than you would do normally. And the obese guys, they're like, oh, I didn't really feel that. I'll have another one. Oh, I didn't really feel that. I'll have another one. You could have done this with food. The exact same response occurs with food, right? But wine was cheaper. Just saying. So even at the early stages when you're consuming something, your microbes are already altering your response to it. Your response to the environment is fundamentally integrated into your microbial self. Your microbiome is another organ, almost, in your body. It's a part of your body, and it's something that's very important if we want to understand the health of that being. One place your microbes come from, and this is, I'm going to go off on a weird tangent here because it's about baboons. But one place your microbes come from is interaction between people, okay? When I shake someone's hand, I transfer microbes to them. When I hug them, I transfer microbes. When I kiss my wife, I transfer microbes. Okay? Just by being in this room, you're all sharing microbes. I'll get onto that in a minute, because that might freak you out. I don't want to freak you out too early. We did this study with baboons in an African troop. The baboons that were more likely to interact, were more grooming. Baboons that groomed each other more shared more microbes. Gastrointestinally, they had more similarity, more similar microbes inside them. So the grooming was leading to an increased amount of microbial sharing. And those females that groomed more actually produced more viable offspring. So we actually postulate, therefore, that social interactions that lead to more microbial sharing may have evolved in order to increase microbial sharing and therefore increase evolutionary fitness. So, next time you hug someone, or you actually shake their hand, or you go to kiss someone, you may want to ask yourself, why? Why am I doing this? I do that a lot. Why am I socially interacting? Why am I actually undergoing this physical interaction with someone? What's driving me to do it? Or maybe, back a while ago when this was important for our evolutionary fitness, having that microbial sharing within your tribe was actually vitally important for the health of the tribe. You were actually sharing microbes, which gave your tribe a benefit. And if you actually had those social interactions in the tribe, you would actually increase the microbial sharing and therefore survive longer and reproduce more and become more successful. And hence, though, your gene, your phenotype, your behavioral responses will get propagated within the community, right? And that, I think, is fascinating. All social interactions may be microbially driven, and they're deciding whether you want a hamburger, and they'll save you from antibiotics. Oh, I don't know. They're awesome. But anyway, so human behavior may have evolved to share beneficial microbes, right? But they also, human neurological processes, the development of them is highly reliant upon those microbes being present. We have a mouse model of autism. And autism is a process which is very close to my heart because of my family. But we are very interested in trying to uncover ways to ameliorate autistic symptoms in people who have autism and to potentially eradicate the development of autism in infants who are suffering from this condition. One way to do this is, again, looking at mice. We have an autistic mouse model. Now, I can't create an autistic mouse. It's impossible. What we have is a mouse that was whose mother was treated in a certain way during pregnancy. She was given an exposure to viral proteins, and this caused her to have an immune response. We call this a maternal immune response mouse. And what this mouse has is it has very similar symptoms to an autistic child. It has neurological disorders related with learning. It has social behavioral differences to other mice. It has repetitive behaviors. It will always go to a certain spot in the cage continuously. And it shows many of the behavioral phenotypes that an autistic child or adult would show. And what we've done is use this mouse model to examine how the microbiome of that mouse model is different from a healthy mouse or a mouse that's neurotypical. Okay? And we can see that there are always differences. And when we know what those differences are, we can track down which of the bacteria or which of the chemicals in their blood that could be related to bacterial activity, which of those bacteria or chemicals are different between those two groups. Right? And then we can treat the mouse. So we can give them antibiotics, or we can change their diet. We can give them different prebiotics, which is essentially changing what they consume. Or we can add bacteria or fungi or whatever back into their body, this probiotic route. Yeah? And we can see which of these kind of treatments drives a disordered phenotype or disordered microbiome or metabolome back to a healthy one. The idea is, can we make that mouse healthy again? Can we change the ratio of bacteria or bacterially mediated chemicals in its bloodstream to make the mouse neurotypical? And in this instance, we were able to do that. So we're able to take this mouse, and by adding in certain bacterial species back into the mouse's body in this probiotic route, with certain dietary components, prebiotic route, these two combinations, we're able to drive its microbiome and its metabolome to look far more like the healthy mouse in the original condition. And when that mouse microbiome and metabolome was healthy, we were actually able to see a significant change in its neurological activity. Its behavior changed, right? It no longer had the stereotypical behaviors. It wasn't constantly doing repetitive activity. It was more socially integrated into the mouse colony it was working with. And the mouse overall had less gastrointestinal problems. There was also a unique histological change. Its gut lining. So many children with autism have a disrupted gut lining. Right, they have a condition called leaky gut. This causes gastrointestinal problems generally, but it also means that more bacterial metabolites, more bacterial chemicals in their gut can get into their bloodstream. This is the same is true for the mouse model. When we gave the mouse this combination of prebiotics and probiotics, its gastrointestinal lining healed up almost miraculously, to the point where none of the significant gastrointestinal problems occurred in that mouse model. The obvious next condition, and this is going to clinical trial with our group over in Caltech and Stanford, we're working on a clinical trial to do this in humans to see if we can ameliorate the same symptoms. This sounds almost miraculous. It's not miraculous. It's not miraculous. It's purely just trying to understand why people with these symptoms have these symptoms, okay? And what we can do to try and drive those symptoms back so they don't cause a problem. Alzheimer's is the same thing. We see that bacterially mediated chemicals in the bloodstream are heavily elevated in patients with Alzheimer's. So GABA or brain-derived neutrophic factors or beta-N-methyloamine L-alanine, that one. These chemicals have, at some point in their synthesis or degradation, a microbial component. So at some point, the bacteria either make or degrade or eat these chemicals. And when we see an increase of these in the bloodstream, it's very highly correlated with an increase in Alzheimer's patient condition. And I, again, another my family's must sound like we're very diseased. My mother's has all of the genetic factors for Alzheimer's. All of my grandparents had Alzheimer's, and two of them died with severe Alzheimer's. Two of them died prior to cancer. God, I really do sound awful. It's the English, you know, we're a diseased race. And I have the genetic factor that predisposes towards Alzheimer's, and so does my eldest son. So I'm very keen to try and figure this problem out. The potential solution is that we alter the microbial community in the gut of these patients to try and affect the concentration of these chemicals in the blood. And to do that, we have to understand what metabolic activity, what eating and consuming activities these bacteria in the gut are doing to create these factors. And which ones are doing it? Can we increase the ones that are good and can knock these things back? And can we decrease the ones that are bad and generating these? And if we can, maybe we can have some significant benefit. We're nowhere near that yet, but we're working very hard to try and figure out what that is. Bacteria can make you fat. Well, of course they can. They're in your gut, right? You know, your gut is the emphasis of what makes you fat because that's where all the food goes in. But this is highly important. I had a friend of mine in Shanghai, Liping Zhao, yeah, very heavy guy. He was 385 pounds, and he went on a diet. He was a scientist. He went on a diet of traditional Chinese whole grain diet. It's not particularly tasty, unless you like whole grains, but it's very effective at making you lose weight because you don't want to eat much of it. Apart from that, he lost 113 pounds in 9 months on this diet, right? So he lost, you know, a third of his body weight by consuming this, well, less than a third, a quarter of his body weight by consuming this diet, right? And he checked his bacterial community in his gut all throughout this transition. And what he saw was that there was one bacteria that was really abundant at the beginning and then absent at the end. It had disappeared. And this bacteria was called Enterobacter cloassiae B29, one organism. Very abundant before the diet, absent at the end. He took that bacteria and he stuck it into mice. And mice with this bacteria put on nearly 60% more weight on the same diet as mice without this bacteria. So the impression was that if I gave mice this organism, they got fat. This was a fat-inducing organism. It made the mouse obese. Okay? It didn't make it eat more. It just transformed the way the food that it was eating interacted with its body. Same calorific intake, and this mouse just has one bacteria different. Right? So maybe this bacteria is processing the food that the mouse consumes differently. Maybe it's making all of the food more bioavailable to the host, right? It's degrading it and giving that energy to the host because those other bacteria weren't as efficient. Maybe this bacteria is just super efficient at degrading the diet of this mouse. It's one theory. We have another one, but before I go on to that, this is important, because this is a bacteria that makes you thin. And this is what everyone wants to hear, right? I know I do. So if you look at monozygotic, these are identical twins, okay? Versus dizygotic twins, this is twin pairs that come from different eggs. We see that monozygotic twins have a slightly more microbiological similarity. They're slightly more microbiologically similar than normal sibling pairs or normal twin pairs. So having an identical genome seems to have some effect on the bacteria which can colonize you. We'll talk about colonization in a minute, but these twins, some of the twin pairs, genetically identical people, you have an obese twin and a lean twin. You know, we say that genetics might be a factor in causing obesity, but when you look at identical twins and you find one that's extremely obese and one that's not, You have to question that, right? Because they both got exactly the same genome. What's interesting is lean individuals have more of a highly hereditable taxon, a bacteria which is passed from mother to child, mother to child, mother to child, down the generations. And this is Christianus Salaciae. If we take a beast person's stool, we take the bacteria living in their poop, right? And we give it to a mouse, not as poop, even though mice are coprophagic. It's a real problem with mice. They eat each other's poop. We could talk about that more later. But if we take the bacteria out of an obese twin's stool and we give it to a mouse, the mouse will gain weight. The bacteria in that woman's stool have an ability to transfer a phenotype, the phenotype in this case being obesity, right? They have an ability to make that mouse obese because something about those bacteria makes the mouse process the food differently, very similar to Enterobacter coriaceae B29. Now, if we take the same woman's stool bacteria and we add Krishnacella minuta, which is a bacterium that's found only in the lean twins, just one bacteria different, and we give that to a mouse, the mouse doesn't gain weight. This one bacteria, Krishnacella minuta, seems to have the capability to prevent this mouse from becoming obese. Right? All the other bacteria in that stool are capable of making a mouse obese, but this one bacterial addition stops that from happening. How? Now, this Krishnacella minuta, it's not counseling out the ability, the metabolic capability of those other organisms. It's not making them less efficient. That doesn't make any sense. How would it do that? There are 500 other species in that gut, and one of those can like so overpower the others that it wipes out their efficiency? I don't buy that. There must be another mechanism. So here at University of Chicago, we've been trying to uncover that other mechanism. Alternatively, we could just, because the probiotic industry is unregulated in this country, so it's a wonderful thing if you're an entrepreneur, not such a wonderful thing if you're a consumer maybe, but that means you can take any bacteria in the world, and as long as it's not a pathogen, you can bottle it and sell it in Whole Foods for $50 a bottle. Yeah. Why am I not doing that? I don't know. Why am I not doing that? Can someone tell me why I'm not doing that? I'm not sure. Maybe I should do that. That'd be awesome. My colleague Ruth Lay, who uncovered this, she should be doing that. It would be extraordinary. And people would buy it. Wouldn't we all buy it? Because we all want a quick solution. We all want something in a bottle that somebody tells us, take this and it will make you better, right? We all want that. It's just not as simple as that. And it's never going to be as simple as that. I would strongly recommend nobody in this room try and hunt down Krishnacella minuta and start consuming it in large quantities in order to try and lose weight. I think it's a very bad idea. And the reason is, we don't know how it works. And I wouldn't sell you a car if I didn't know how it worked. I wouldn't fly an airplane if I was a pilot if I didn't know how the airplane worked. I wouldn't rely on something unless I could understand what it was doing and the potential side effects of that activity, right? So at University of Chicago, with Gene Chang, who's one of my colleagues in medicine, we've been trying to uncover this mechanism. We know, it's a complicated diagram, but we'll take it bit by bit. We know that if you have a mouse without any bacteria in it, so-called germ-free mouse, right? If you have a mouse without any bacteria living inside it, and we give it a low-fat diet, like a diet like my wife wants me to eat, versus a high-fat diet, which I can get at lunchtime when my wife's not looking. My wife is actually totally not like controlling my diet. I'm just saying that. But she probably should be. But anyway. What we see in the germ-free animal is that the mouse stays lean. No matter what kind of food it's eating, no matter what kind of calorific intake it gets, it stays lean. And what we see is, this is a brain and a liver. What we see is that the cycles, the clocks which drive the circadian rhythm, the day-night cycle observation of those two organs is not disrupted. All right, let me take a step back. You all have a clock inside you, many clocks. Every single one of your organ has a clock. Your liver has a clock. Your stomach has a clock. Your brain has a clock. Even your lungs have a clock. And all the cells inside those organs have a clock which regulates their activity. If you start working nights or you become chronically jet-lagged because you just flew to China, your brain clock gets all messed up. And that sends signals to the rest of your body's clocks which can't catch up in time. And what you get is a disrupted clock mechanism, and your clock's not on the same time as the country you're in. Or if you're working nights, your body's not on the same time as the cycle you're in. And what this actually means is your metabolism gets messed up. People that are chronically jet-lagged or people that are working nights put on more weight for the same amount of food consumed. Right? Their bodies aren't responding appropriately to the right food. What we showed is that if you have no bacteria inside an animal, no matter what diet you give it, it stays lean. If you give a low-fat diet to an animal with bacteria, you get normal circadian function in the brain and the liver, normal clocks working properly, and the mouse stays lean. If we give an animal a high-fat diet when it's got bacteria in it, we get aberrant, we get microbial signatures in the gut, which are really weird. They don't cycle normally. And that leads to disruptions in your brain's clock and your liver's clock, which leads to obesity. So what this suggests is that the same mechanism by which somebody working nights puts on more weight than someone working in the day, right? Exactly that same mechanism of disrupted body clocks is also occurs when you eat a high-fat diet. But instead of affecting your sleep cycle, it affects your gut microbiota, which alters your body's clocks. What happens here, this is really interesting, the high-fat diet changes the bacteria which release certain chemicals into your bloodstream which go to your liver. They then change your liver clock, different to your brain clock. These get completely and utterly dysregulated. Your liver clock is a clock which has a particular efficacy for changing the amount of weight you put on. And so the animal becomes obese. It starts putting on more weight for the same calorific intake. And so what we think is the Christianocella minuta and Enterobacter cloacae are organisms which can alter our body clocks. And by altering our body clocks, they can determine whether we become obese or lean for the same amount of food eaten. And that is the why somebody out there, is going to remain nameless, can eat as many damn hot dogs as they want and never put on any weight. And I have to watch what I eat. In fact, and I haven't got a book to sell before I say this, but by following this mechanism, I lost 40 pounds in 12 weeks. I altered the types of foods I ate, and I changed the cycle of eating during the day to have a really big breakfast, a small lunch, and a small dinner, and I lost 40 pounds in 12 weeks with virtually no exercise, which was awesome. I used to weigh 205 pounds. I now weigh about 165. And by doing that, I was able to change the body's metabolic mechanism and alter how my body processed food. And essentially, this comes down to eat a big breakfast. And when I told that to my mum, she said, duh, I've been telling you that like your entire life and you never listen to me. And I'm like, yeah, sorry, mum. But now we published it, we proved it. And she goes, yeah, so I knew that. Now, see, this is interesting, right? Circadian rhythms can change up your life. And if you have a disrupted circadian rhythm, your brain is feeling it and it's affecting your liver. But now we know that the gut microbes, the bacteria inside your intestine can affect your liver, which then affects your brain. So not only do you have an altered physiological response to food, but you also have an altered metabolism and neurological behavior in your brain. You actually start craving the food that you eat, right? So it's a positive feedback mechanism. You start eating a lot of fatty foods, you get a disrupted circadian rhythm in your gut, you start putting on more weight, which makes you more sedentary, but it also sends signals to your brain once your brain gets on the same circadian rhythm as your gut, which makes you more sleepy or drowsy at certain parts of the day, and then you start craving, weirdly, the foods which you ate. And we think this is an evolutionary mechanism. We think the bacteria have evolved this over 60 to 100 million years of mammal evolution. They've evolved this mechanism to actually allow them to keep you in a state which makes them happy. So you keep on eating the foods to make the ecosystem inside the gut the one that they want to see, the one that they want to live in. So where did the Enterobacter cloacae B29 where did that come from? Where did the Christianocella minuta that made the twin lean, where did that come from? Where did she get it from? I said it was highly hereditable. Maybe it came from a mother. But this is very interesting. A lot of the bacteria in our body come from our mother. You're actually born mostly sterile, right? And depending upon which route you come out, by a cesarean or the other way, you actually get a different microbial exposure. These are dots. Each one dot is a microbial sample taken from either a baby or from the mother that was involved in the delivery of the child. The blue dots over here, the dark blue dots, are bacterial communities taken from a skin swab on the back of the mother's hand, right? And the blue dots here are baby's oral and gastrointestinal microbiome taken from a baby delivered by cesarean section. The closer these dots are together, the more microbiologically similar they are. Babies born via cesarean section have microbial communities that look like mother's skin. Babies born via the vaginal delivery route have bacterial communities which look like their mother's vaginal microbiota, right? Which way did you evolve to be born? Yes. Yeah, we're great. We're learning. This is the potential way we have to do this sometimes, unfortunately. One of my colleagues, who loves the microbiome too, his wife had to give birth and she had to have an emergency C-section. So there's a way you can do this. You can have an implanted sponge which you then inoculate the baby with afterwards. So instead of coming out the normal route, you take the sponge after cesarean birth and you then just inoculate manually the baby's oral cavity and skin and everything like that. And if you do that, the baby's microbiome starts to look like this. This is your starting culture. If you come from San Francisco, this is your sourdough bread. If you come from Minnesota, this is your beer culture. If you come from France, I don't know, this is your yeast for your wine. This is what makes you, kicks you up on the route to becoming who you are. And these microbes stay with you for about a year, right? The microbes your mother gives to you via her skin, via her oral contact, and by her vaginal delivery, they all stay with you for a long while. They feature very heavily in your microbial self in your early stages of life. But it's not the only story. Your mother's, even her milk has its own microbiome, right? The body actually starts to actively recruit bacteria via the lymph system, shepherded by your immune system. Your immune system releases immunoglobulins, which grab hold of bacteria from mucosal surfaces all around the body and takes them in via the lymph system and deposits them in the breast tissue. And then those bacteria are actively given to the child through the breast milk. So the breast milk contains a prebiotic, lots of lovely fats and sugars and protein, and it also contains a probiotic, actively delivered to the child and evolutionarily designed to be effective in the degradation or the consumption of breast milk, plus the training of the baby's immune system. But even that's not the only story. It's a great story focused on the Amish and the Hutterites. And it's slight sideline, but bear with me. I'll tell you the story. This is the love story, maybe. I don't know. I like the love story idea. It's great. The Amish and the Hutterites are two Eastern European religious orders that came over and set up home in America, right? And we have about 35,000 Amish living in northern Indiana. And we have another population of around 50,000 Hutterites living in South Dakota or North Dakota. A Dakota. And what's interesting about these guys is that they both live very similar lives. They both have eschewed technology up to a certain point. They like the plow, but beyond then, it's not cool. They don't like electricity. Their homes are immaculately clean. They make me, I'm a little OCD maybe, but these guys are super OCD. Their homes are like dusted constantly. They don't use vacuums. They just use brushes and pans, but the homes are spotless. It's remarkable. They don't use really any chemicals. They just, they live a reasonably chemical-free life, sure. Now, the Amish have one significant difference to the Hutterites, actually two. One of them is important. The Amish live on family farms. If you've ever been to an Amish farm, you'll see that the kids really don't have games. My kids don't like going to the farm because they're made to feel guilty for playing on their iPads while the rest of the kids are doing work. All the kids work. From birth, pretty much. You're sitting there milking on your mother while she's milking the cow. You're in the barn constantly. You are interacting with the environment around you from birth, right? You are constantly exposed to a rich and diverse microbial flora. The Hutterites, only boys over the age of 14 are allowed on the farm. And they're all shipped in there. So the carriage comes along and it picks up each working male from each household and they go to a centralized farm facility where they then do all the work. Women and children aren't allowed on the farm. I don't know why. Don't ask me that. Somebody asks me that every time, and I have no idea. But it's an interesting point. The Amish have no allergy or asthmas. No asthma or allergies, sorry, in their population. Virtually none, less than 0.001% of their population, shows any of these illnesses. The Hutterites have elevated levels of asthma and allergies over the U.S. average. Right, the U.S. average is around 7 or 8% for asthma, for example. Hutterites have around 13 to 14%. They need double. And there's something to be said for that. Number one, take your kids down to an Amish farm and rub their faces in the dirt. That's what I started doing. Number two, maybe we should be selling the dirt here. Maybe it's really cool. We could go and all sell it on Weibo or on Amazon and make a lot of money. Or number three, something about their lifestyle is actually leading to the development of a healthy immune system. What's interesting is if you take children who are growing up on a traditional American farm, right? They don't have this. They have reduced levels of asthma and allergies over the US average, but not significantly. It's maybe 5 to 6%. So about 1 or 2%, 3% reduced below the national average. Right? Even if it's an organic farm versus a non-organic farm, no significant difference in the allergy and asthma rate in the population growing up on that farm. It's not that. It's not the chemical exposure. What is it? Magic? I don't know. That's why we have to study it. So we're actually actively trying to understand what this, what's going on here. We think it's actually their lifestyle. We think it's actually the number of physical interactions they have with the microbial world on a regular basis. Most farms, the children aren't actively forced to go out and do the work morning, noon, and night. They are actually brought up in a traditional American way, right? They can watch TV. They can go and play video games with their friends. Not so on this farm. We don't fully understand it yet, but we're starting to get there. Now, I said I'd gross you out a little bit. I probably will. Right? The clothes you're wearing are no barrier to your microbial selves. If you think that the clothes you're wearing are actually stopping you from microbially interacting with the chairs or with any other surface you touch, such as, you know when you want to open the door handle to the washroom and you, like, you pull down your sleeve and you're like that? Don't. It doesn't make any difference. Your microbes on your skin and the microbes on the door handle are interacting quite happily through that material. This is like loose fishnet stockings to the bacteria. And when you sat down, when you came in, you released this puff of microbial cells. In fact, I can go into any student lecture I give, and if I swab these seats after the lecture, I could tell whether a woman or a man had been sitting on that sofa, on the chair. I could tell the gender specificity of each person sitting on that chair, right? You can draw your own conclusions as to why. But your microbial cells are not contained within you. They are all around you. And this environment we've created for ourselves, this built environment, is just perpetuating that relationship. Your microbial ecosystem is being released into this room and then feeding back upon you. Now, if we were doing this, 5,000 years ago, we probably wouldn't be indoors. Or if we were indoors, it would be in a big open space. And we'd probably be, you know, sitting around a campfire or, you know, like, doing something else. I don't know what, I don't even think when 5,000 years ago was. But it was probably wasn't in an air-conditioned building in the middle of Chicago. So there's something dynamic that's happened to our lives. And one of those things that's happened is we've moved indoors. Now, 90% of our lives in the Western world are spent indoors. If you live in Chicago, it's usually about 99% because it's either too hot or too bloody cold to go outside. So you end up spending a lot of time in this manufactured ecosystem, okay, with the air conditioning on or the heating on, and you rarely open the windows. And you then just get this constant reaffirmation of your microbiome. And if you take a child, you know, remember, they're born sterile, they acquire the microbes from their mother, but then they acquire the microbes from the environment in which they are placed. The Amish children get them from all the animals they interact with. The Hutterite children get them from their mother and the other children playing in the house. The normal children just get them from whatever's going on inside that space. And they may not get much interaction outside of that. And that may be a fundamental reason why most children grow up, 7 to 8% of them grow up with some kind of autoimmune disorder. And we need to be able to understand what is triggering that. In the home microbiome study, we really fundamentally started to look at the microbial interaction we have with the space. To really understand it as a map. We wanted to map which bacteria are moving between us and the space. If you see red lines here, this is a microbial sample which can be used to identify a family. So if I take a bedroom floor sample from family 2, any microbial sample that I took off this bedroom floor could be identified as coming from that family. Family 1, similar. Most of the bedroom floor samples and kitchen floor samples could be identified to that family. Kitchen light switches, I took a swab of that kitchen light switch. I couldn't really identify that family from that sample. This is important. This is forensics. I can utilize each one of your unique microbial signatures to identify you, to track you in a space, because I can see family one's microbiome being left on the floor, and I can disassociate it into each of those family members. I can even use it to tell what you're doing. So in this study, we utilize a couple living with a lodger, right? Again, as the dots are closer together, the sample is more similar. And this young couple in red and blue here, they are more microbiologically similar than they were to their lodger, who they were living with. They weren't physically interacting with the lodger, probably a good thing for them. But the lodger was still more microbiologically similar to them than he was to anyone else in the study, because he was living in the same space and acquiring microbes from that space from the young couple. And we can use this information in either nefarious or healthy ways. One of the nefarious ways is to develop a national database of the microbiome, so I can track every single person in this room and find out exactly what you've been doing, who you've been interacting with, and what you ate for lunch. That'd be fun. We could do that. Or we could use it to actually identify a personal medical reason why you might not be responding to your particular drug regimen. And so this is very important. Understanding how you interact with a space isn't just about trying to map the way a microbes move between each other. It can be used for medical purposes. We want to be able to identify you individually. We also want to be able to identify how you're picking up pathogens in an environment. So, for example, this is a young family, two adults and two children. These are the floors, and these are the counters and doorknobs and light switches. And we can see that the bacteria are moving from hands to surfaces which hands normally interact with, right? And you can see that feet are moving to floors, which feet normally interact with. This hand belonged to my youngest son, to my family. And you can see that when my son was about 1.5, 2 years old, he was really quite consistently microbially interacting with the bedroom floor, spending a lot of time crawling on the bedroom floor, and his feet and his hand were microbially interacting with that space in a much more rigorous way than the more bipedal people among the family. This is my eldest son doing his microbial swabbing. So just like you guys might have done earlier with Jared at the back there, he was actively swabbing his microbiome daily, right? You can do it with your kids. It's not legal. That's not illegal, right, Jared? I can do that? Yeah, Jared's not even paying attention. He's like, what? What? I'm allowed to do that. I'm sure I'm allowed to do that. You can experiment on your children. That's fine. They're my children. I made them, right? 50% of me. The 50% of me that's them decided that it was okay. So we've just been swabbing each other constantly in order to try and understand that build-up and interaction. This is Jared's house. I can say that, right? And Jared has dogs. And dogs are awesome. Dogs increase the complexity of the microbial sharing. It looks like a spaghetti ball, right? The dogs are actually actively interacting with each member of the household and with pretty much every surface and spreading microbes around in a consistent way. Dogs are really, really good at this. They come up and they are promiscuous. This is my dog, Bo Diggley. And Bo is a hell of a promiscuous dog. Anybody goes up and sniffs their butts and then gives them a cuddle and licks them all over and is sharing microbes. People that own dogs are more likely to share more microbes than people that don't own dogs. Dogs actively increase the amount of microbial sharing people experience. And they also, children that grow up with dogs are less likely to develop asthma and allergies. Might be a correlation there. No causation of yet, but there's a correlation. We know that this happens because we can take bacteria from a dog, lactobacillus in this case, give it to a mouse with asthma, and the mouse will not suffer from asthmatic attacks, or it has a significantly reduced likelihood of having an asthmatic attack. So the lactobacillus from the dog seems to interact with the mouse's immune system and feeds back on it to prevent the mouse from having an allergic reaction to whatever stimulus was occurring. And this is highly important, right? This is why dogs are awesome. So I want to put microbes in your medical records, right? This is tricky. I come from a country where it's very easy to do that because we have a national health service. I could sit down here. Like, all right. America. All right. The national health service isn't bad. It's just not as good as yours. But that's not a point to hate it. I can go to any doctor in America. I can go to any doctor in England and I can get the medical records for myself for my entire life, from birth through to the point I'm at now. I can't do that in this country. You guys don't share medical records the way you probably should do. That's the CIA checking up on me. It's all right. It's all right. Gotta revoke my citizenship status. Send me back to Blighty. I want to put microbes in your medical records, but I want them to be available to you. I want to make sure that you can track your microbiome daily and that you can use that information to interact with your medical service providers so that you can tell them how your treatment should go, right? To be more involved in your understanding of your health system, right? One way to do that is to put your these devices that can monitor your health back into your home. So we've been actively developing a microbial toilet sensor so that every morning, when you're doing what you do in the morning, you know, checking your emails. Yeah, I know. All right, checking your emails in the morning and you've done what you need to do. Your microbial sensor will tell you on your microbial sensor app, patented. I'm joking. I should do, though. God, I'm bad at this business thing. It will tell me exactly what I have in my gut today, and potentially I could develop an algorithm that tells me, this is the reason I'm walking backwards and forwards, my Fitbit app. So I've done 11,000 steps today, which is pretty good. 6.26 miles, that's not bad. Anyway, this app could tell me exactly what I should have for breakfast. So maybe I should have blueberries for breakfast. Well, my app could tell me because it wants to rebalance my microbiome and keep it healthy. And so having that information in the palm of your hand, being able to tell you exactly how you should day-to-day manage your body, may be an incredibly effective way at helping us to prevent the onset of major conditions which we all fear. It wasn't until really the 1920s, 1930s that we really started to give a crap about cancer. Okay, that was because before that, we were all too busy dying of tuberculosis. When we got rid of using extremely efficacious methods of public works, of vaccination, of antibiotics in the late 40s, when we got rid of all the nasty pathogens that were killing us, we started noticing that other things were killing us. Now we've started to notice that maybe our modern-day lifestyle is actually starting to have an impact upon our health too. And so we need to be able to monitor the way we interact with the modern-day environment so that we can effectively control that interaction to lead us to a more health-benefiting society. It's an example of that. These are two people that had their microbiome sequenced every day for a year. You can see two striking things. One, this guy looks different to this guy. Let me explain this diagram a bit. The bumps and leaps are is the density of microbial cells per gram of feces, right? So it's the number of cells you find in each gram of poo. This guy has more blue bacteria, Bacteroidetes. This guy has more purple bacteria, and he has some of these red and yellow bacteria as well. They have different microbiomes. That's that microbial uniqueness each of you have. This guy he's an MIT professor, and he had a dodgy burrito at Harvard campus one time. Never eat at Harvard. Awful. And he got salmonella poisoning. He went to the doctor. The doctor told him he had norovirus. Go home. Don't take antibiotics. You'll be fine. Came back 4 days later with his microbiome results saying, actually, I had salmonella poisoning, and you didn't give me an antibiotic, but I got better, so I'm not going to sue you. But anyway, this information is a diagnostic tool. It could be used to actually help us out. This is an interesting point. This green blob here, this guy didn't get sick. He just moved to Bangkok, Thailand, and lived there with his wife for 6 weeks. And he didn't get sick. He just got a different microbiome. He's drinking different water, breathing different air, eating different foods, and it changed his microbial self. Now, if he was to take a drug for a condition when he was in Bangkok, his body and his microbiome specifically may have reacted differently to that drug compared to when he was in America. Okay, and that's very important. Where you are and how it's affecting your microbiome could change the way your body responds to a treatment. So we have to understand that for personalized medicine. So to explore this, we started up a public crowdsource funding campaign. After being told by the National Institutes of Health that our project wasn't particularly effective and we should go back and come up with some hypotheses, any scientists in the room will understand the pain of that, we decided, nope, we're going to put an American flag on it and sell it to the public so you guys can fund it. And we now have a British one as well with the British flag on it. And so basically we asked people to have their microbiome sequenced and to pay a small donation to have it done. And then all that data becomes public, so that any scientist anywhere in the world in any community can use that information to actually understand how the microbial signatures they see in their study, how that really compares to an entire population of people. We actually have a little over 10,000 people now in the combined study, and we're hoping to get hundreds of thousands over the time. And this is non-for-profit, but it enables you to contribute to science. I'm not asking you to. I don't care if you do it or not, but we actually got a bunch of your microbiomes back there, so we'll probably add them in. But this is important. It helps us as a community to really understand what it is about the microbes that live inside you as a unique person, what it is about those microbes that could be affecting your health, could be affecting your disease treatment. And we really need to understand that. I'll skip over Michael Pollan. We've done this with a family. So we looked at a mother, a father, their daughter and their son, and their son has crippling allergies. And this didn't really come out very well on this picture, but we use this information to figure out why that son's microbiome was different to the microbiome of the rest of the family. They're obviously living together. The son and the daughter picked up their microbiome from their mother. They were both vaginally delivered and breastfed. We know that that microbial transfer happened, but something went wrong with the son's metabolism, immune condition. So he suffered from severe allergies. And so we found that the son contained it was missing about four different bacterial taxa that the rest of the family had, and contained two bacterial taxa which the rest of the family didn't have. Everything else was pretty much unimportant. Thanks. So, it might be my slide, this projector. But some of these organisms were highly important. And so what we're trying to do is utilize this information to develop probiotics that could potentially be used to treat that kid's condition, giving him the right bacteria back and potentially reducing the abundance of those other organisms. Tailored, personalized treatment for an individual. Because most of the probiotics you find out there aren't very effective at treating anything. Right. Just as a joke, you can up the lights again, thanks. Peter Littlewood is the director at Argonne. He's one of my bosses. And Eric Isaacs is the director, he's the provost at University of Chicago. He's my other boss. So, for a joke, at the first version of this lecture I did back in December, I have updated it, but I did their microbiomes. And I sequenced them, and I wanted to find out how they compared to the US average and what made them different, and if I could say anything about their health. They're not in the room today, so I can be even more cheeky. 82% of people with a microbiome like Peter Littlewood's exercise rarely to occasionally. How much you exercise, what physical activity you have, has an effect upon the bacteria that live inside you. Changes your diet, for one. It also changes your nutrient requirements. And that actually actively feeds back upon the microbial community inside your gut. So we can see that. 45% of people with a microbiome like Eric's exercise regularly. It's not particularly high level, but it turns out that this guy actually does a lot of cycling up and down the path, and Peter doesn't. Peter's actually British as well, so I have to shake my head in shame. And these are lower numbers, but 37% of people with a microbiome like Peter's take probiotics regularly. Turns out Peter didn't take probiotics, so I was quite glad about that low number. 42% of people with a microbiome like Eric's regularly take vitamins. He does take vitamins. I don't know, it's only a percentage, but it's interesting. They both slept well, and the amount you sleep, as I suggested with obesity, can potentially affect the microbiome and vice versa. And both of these guys had a very similar sleep-based microbiome. 53% of people with a microbiome like Peter's eat very few vegetables, whereas 61% of people with a microbiome like Eric's eat quite a lot of plants and vegetables a week. So we see, this potential. This guy actually does eat a lot more meat. And Eric's mostly vegetarian. So we actually see a differentiation in the microbiome. This is pretty much what I can say about people's microbiome in this system. Now, I'm interested in putting this information, just to finish up now, into something which I can use. This is a map of the city of Chicago and obviously Indiana. And what we're looking at here are 10,000 Chicago households over 2 weekdays in 2008. This is time. This is 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the morning. And these are their activities. So the blue dots are people at work. The yellow dots are people at school. The red dots are people going shopping, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see Chicago is not maybe the most exciting place, because you'd think that when it got into the evening, about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd start to see some people doing other things. Mostly they're going on to recreational activities, but those are all the kids. There's really no nightlife. We didn't see much in the way of people actually doing anything much in the week. Maybe that's good, they're all working. But this information is from people, nothing to do with their microbiome. But I want to be able to track their microbiome in the same way that I can track their personal activity. Because if I can do that, maybe I can design better ways to build cities. Maybe I can create new initiatives to improve urban design. Maybe I can lead this to better architectural patterns. So we've been working with a group, Chicago and Argonne, called the Array of Things. And these are boxes which are going up on lights, fittings, and intersections around Chicago, which are monitoring information about the environment. Everything from temperature and carbon dioxide to air density, air quality, the microbial community, and even tweets. And what we're using this information for is to try and understand how urban environments, how they're designed, how that affects the environment in which we all live, right? How we can use this information to potentially design better environments, better urban systems that could have potentially improved health benefits. So on the baseline of that, if there shouldn't be any sound with this, but hopefully it won't give you sound, we want to create a microbiome initiative that really leads us to building better environmental systems. And that means that understanding how our microbial cells, how our microbial ecosystems are shaped by this urban environment. We now live in an urban world. We are an increasingly urban species. Most of the people, most of the growth in populations around the world is urban growth. And yet we don't really understand how cities work, especially not cities with indoor environments, with controlled ventilation. We think that the best way is just to remove all microbial life, but maybe it's not. Maybe we need to design cities better so that the microbial world inside our rooms is as diverse as an Amish farm, that can lead children growing up in those spaces to have an increased microbial diversity and potentially improved health. I think only by doing this can we actually have an effect. I can't make everyone live on an Amish farm. I can't make everyone return to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But potentially I can bring the Amish farm and the hunter-gatherer lifestyle into the urban environment and create an ecosystem whereby they can survive and thrive without being plagued by some of these modern conditions which we've developed. And I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a really wonderful talk.
Thank you.
My question is actually related to something you didn't mention, but another microbiologist mentioned that the analysis of the bacteria growing in the gut of hunter-gatherer populations are really diverse compared to all Western populations. I was wondering if you could comment on why you think that is.
Yeah, so this is Amazonian Indians who have theoretically never been contacted. This is very interesting research. We were actually involved partially in it with the Hadza tribe out in Africa. We know that their lifestyle is obviously a lot more diverse. You know, they are constantly in interaction with the environment. We know that they haven't taken any antibiotics, although the antibiotic resistance burden in their microbiome is the same as a Western person's. This is because antibiotics aren't a modern invention. They've been around for 4 billion years. You know, bacteria have been killing each other with antibiotics for, 4 billion years. So, of course, there's antibiotic resistance inside everybody's microbiome. But that being said, I think they were living a life and they had a much less reduction in the microbial cells than we do in our modern world. There's a payoff with that. They don't have any of the medical services that we have. They mostly have an average age of around 38. So you got to trade. We got to have a balance in our ecosystem, right? I want to live to 80. I'm just about to turn 40. I don't want to die at 40, right? That would suck. No offense to anyone. No, that would suck, wouldn't it? Why would that be offending? I actually want to get old. I'm not going to be a who. Should I die before I get old? You know. Anyway, I sidetrack. I want to live old. So I've got to utilize medical advances to prevent that, but prevent death. But what I want to do also is make sure that whatever microbial experience I'm getting is effective. And there might be some things we can learn from those people. Some things about the way their microbiome has evolved, the way it stabilized, the way it colonized them, and the way it's treating their immune system that we could use. The ones that do survive, maybe they are healthier. But we have to bear that in mind, the ones that do survive. Because most of them die in infancy. And we don't want that in our population.
Dr. Gilbert, I just want to say again, it was very enlightening. And I'd like to give you another clap.
Appreciate it.
If I heard you correctly early on, you said most of the bacteria was in your intestine. Is that correct?
That's right.
I saw a case where someone had a significant part of their intestine removed. And shortly thereafter, they contracted both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Do you see a causal connection between that, especially the disruption of the gut microbes?
I can't comment on an individual case, but any potential disruption could have some kind of effect. Those are, to get Parkinson's and Alzheimer's in one patient, that's pretty severe. And both of them have very different phenotypes. So that would be pretty horrendous to see. It could have happened. Yes.
Can you say something about toxoplasmosis and whether you would claim it as an excuse for risky behavior. And then my second question is about prisoners in solitary confinement, if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, so, well, toxoplasmosis, obviously a nasty eukaryote, if you get it. It's in cats. It's the reason we don't normally recommend cats. I like cats, actually. Not really very much. But we have something called the... I like dogs better. We have something called the Kitty Microbiome Project, which we're doing currently as a crowdsourced effort. So people are sending in poop from their cats and having it microbiologically sequenced. And what's remarkable is a lot of cats actually, we're doing 18S sequencing alongside 60S. So we're looking at the eukaryotes and the bacteria. And toxoplasmosis is a eukaryote. And a lot of cats have toxoplasmosis in them, but it's not actually being actively transmitted to the human population at that time. So... yeah, if you've got an outdoor cat, that's probably a good thing. An indoor cat, maybe not. The use of toxoplasmosis as a... some people are suggesting this could be highly efficacious in actually affecting a better immune system response in people. And we haven't seen any direct evidence to support that. So I would hold off on any judgment in that area. People in solitary confinement. Depression and anxiety can co-occur if you're living in a confined space, but there's probably many reasons that could be happening. We have actually been exploring this with soldiers who are in solitary confinement due to misconduct in the armed forces. And they show a very different microbiome despite a very similar diet regimen. So we're wondering whether isolation for longer periods of time could be altering their microbial flora. Now, linking that back in any causal way to neurological deficit or depression is very difficult. You can't do experiments on human beings. But we're definitely concerned about that area. Well, of course, yeah, I mean, you know, there are many fungi and many eukaryotes which can have impacts on human behavior or any mammal behavior. When these kind of bugs get inside rats and mice, they're attracted to cat urine. So they go and actively hang around cats, cat urine, and the cats come along and eat them. And then the pathogen gets transmitted to the cat and completes its life cycle. So, you know, microbes can alter neurological behavior in many different ways.
Thanks. Two questions. Monsanto's herbicide glyphosate affects soil organisms in dramatic ways and our gut organisms. Have you done anything or explored anything about repairing the gut damage from that? And the second question, for those of us who have leaky gut and have for 20-plus years trying to heal it unsuccessfully, as well as either were born C-section or weren't breastfed, how do we access those 80 or so probiotics that we missed? And do we knock on an Amish woman's door who's breastfeeding and say,
can I have some?
And would that even, you know, or a probiotic supplement, would that even affect in a positive way?
To answer question number one, glyphosate hasn't been shown in any human studies to affect human microbial communities, and we still don't have any direct evidence that glyphosate has any impact upon human health. That being said, there's no reason why it wouldn't, but I'm just saying it doesn't. We have no evidence of it. We know that it affects the microbiome of cows, and so it's highly probable that it would affect other mammals. But still, the health effects and the causality are still under study. And I have full disclosure of interest. I have no conflict with any organization that produces glyphosate or is interests as our financial due to glyphosate. But I'm an evidence-based person, and I haven't seen any work in that area. We are interested in that because there is a propensity towards chemical exposure leading to the development of things like Parkinson's. And so we're keen to try and uncover the potential interactions there. But it's very complex. Let's leave it at that. In getting a fecal microbiome transplants, this is a common mechanism by which people are reacquiring a healthy microbiome. It's like an organ transplant, right? You know, it's like getting something from somebody else and trying to implant it so it works. We don't necessarily understand all the mechanisms by which it works, but we know it works. So I'm keen to uncover the mechanisms behind that, and we are working with people to try and get their microbiomes when they're healthy and then potentially re-implant them when they're sick. And there is a program that we're trying to develop at Chicago whereby a patient comes in, we take the microbiome before they go into surgery, and then we can potentially repopulate their microbiome or repopulate their microbiome after they've had surgery. And we think the hypothesis is that this will significantly alleviate post-surgical depression and even post-surgical infection rates. So we're very interested in that idea. The evidence still isn't there to categorically state whether it will be effective or not, and that's the reason we have to do the research. Thank you. Yes?
Okay, so you were talking about like biological clocks in different organs and how that affects your microbiome. So I was wondering, like, some people are morning people and other people are night people.
Yeah.
So, like, would that make a difference in your microbiome?
This is a really interesting question, right? And absolutely, I think it does, because if you're an early riser and you have a big breakfast, say like a lot of cereal or a lot of bacon and eggs early in the morning, we see that people that do that have a significant increase in certain bacteria over people that rise late and grab a bite to eat before they go rushing to work or school, right? Again, it comes down to what my mother always told me, which was have a big breakfast, right? But this is really interesting, because when you have if you have the wrong kind of diet, and I don't know what the wrong kind of diet is, but you eat the wrong kinds of foods, like you eat too many hamburgers and hot dogs, right? You actually shift your waking schedule. So people that eat more of that stuff are generally they're more awake at night and less awake in the morning. And people that don't eat fatty foods are generally more awake in the morning and less awake at night. And I will guarantee you, there'll be loads of people in this room will say, well, that's not true for me. That's why it's an average. But it's a very interesting spectrum of relationships, and we never really understood why. Everyone goes, well, you're eating too many carbs, and therefore you're really tired at night, right? But it's probably because it has some effect upon your microbiome, which is altering your body clock. I know that when I stopped eating a lot of fatty foods and started eating a lot of big breakfast. When I say fatty foods, I mean saturated fats. I now eat a lot of bacon. I love bacon. It's great. And eggs. Eggs are really good for you. And I eat those in the morning along with like cereal. When I do that, I started waking up much earlier, and I felt much more awake in the morning. Like I got up at 6 a.m. and I was like, "Whoa, let's really go!" You know. And I think that had a massive effect upon my psychological health. It potentially made me crazier. I don't know.
Hi. So microbes don't actually care whether they're on a human or a mouse or a cow or a dog. They're all the same.
Well, yes and no, right? So mouse, dog, human, cow, they're all mammals. They all have the same progenitor, and we see very similar types of bacteria colonizing those different groups. But remember, you get a lot of those bacteria early in life and ones that stay with you from your mother. So there's a certain element of vertical transmission, right? If I was born to a cow, I would probably get more microbes similar to a cow. If I ate like a cow, I might have more microbes look like a cow. And also, the interior of a cow is very different from the interior of a human, so it's a different ecosystem. So, you know, if I took a baby and I just, a sterile baby, and I've been desperately wanting to do this, but it's unethical, took a sterile baby and I just put it in a house and saw what colonized that baby, I would probably see the very same thing colonizing that baby as a germ-free mouse. So we've done that. We take germ-free sterile mice and we put them in spaces, and they always pick up the microbes of the house, right? If I do the same to a baby, it would see exactly the same thing. But could I make the microbiome of a baby look like the microbiome of a mouse? Maybe, but it's very difficult. And it takes some. We know this because if we take human stool and we feed it to a mouse, it doesn't always look like a human. So there's complex interspecies dynamics there which need to be worked out. But they're two different ecosystems, right?
Especially in India, there's a lot of resistance of the mycobacterium tuberculosis with the drugs. Now, what you are saying, does it have any place to alter the sensitivity of the mycobacterium tuberculosis?
Well, okay, mycobacterium tuberculosis is a really, really tricky character. So when we look at how this organism infects us, it's a horrible disease, right? If you were alive in the 19th century, you would know quite a few family members who died of tuberculosis, right? You would know many friends who had died of tuberculosis, and death would have been quite common in your world. To the point where most Victorian people in the UK used to take pictures of themselves sitting or standing next to the dead person who just died, dressed in full regalia, right? This is quite common. It's dead. I don't know why you would do that, because death was normal, right? Everyone died, and they died quite a lot, so you just got used to it. And it's a brilliant bug, though, from a microbiological perspective. What it does is when it gets inside you above a certain threshold of inoculation, enough cells get inside you, it actually turns your immune system against the rest of the bacteria living inside your body. So it actually, what it does is it makes your immune system generate antimicrobial peptides. These are little proteins which kill off other bacteria. And it's resistant to those antimicrobial peptides, but most other bugs in the gut aren't. So it turns on the immune system, tells it to kill off the rest of the bugs that are living inside you, and then it takes over the real estate left behind, right? So it's like an awesome property developer. It clears the slums and then takes over everything, right? And then makes a living, and then kills the person, which is probably not a good idea. But there is definitely an interaction between there, and we don't entirely understand how to prevent that. I couldn't cure mycobacterium tuberculosis infection with a microbiome transfer. I know that. But there must be a way of maybe strengthening, through synthetic biology, strengthening the microbiome to be resistant against these antimicrobial peptides so that when one of these bacteria came in, it couldn't take over because all the real estate was taken up and there was nowhere to move into, and it couldn't kill off the rest of the bugs. Now, that's genetic modification of the intestinal microbiota, and whoa, you know, that's a big issue, so I won't go there. But yeah, it's a really interesting point. And trying to understand that resistance pattern, especially in tuberculosis, and especially in populations that are still suffering from this, is incredibly interesting.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
With all your research in this field, one of the things you said, you started eating a bigger breakfast.
Yes.
Are there other lifestyle changes that you have made, and that you, if so, could you share with us?
I got a dog.
Got a dog?
Yeah. We rescued Bo from Kentucky Kill Shelter. Someone was going to kill him as a puppy because, you know, you don't want too many puppies in the world. But we rescued him, and he's awesome, you know. And we introduced him into our home after my wife saw some of the results from the work that we were doing. So choosing to rescue Bo was an active decision based on our research. Choosing to have a big breakfast was an active decision based on our research. So I am actually trying to live what we uncover and testing them on myself. Obviously, I'm an N of one, so I can't take my information and use it for any benefit to anyone else, but I'm trying to see if any of them have any efficacious nature in my own family. The other things, you know, I eat a lot of leafy vegetables. People wash their leafy vegetables, that's fine, you can wash them. There's loads of bacteria inside the leaf. You know, there's loads of endophytic organisms that live inside the plants. And when you eat the leafy vegetables, you're actually eating a lot of bacteria as well, and they're good for you, right? We think. So I strongly suggest people do that, and I encourage them to do it for their kids. And if you have young children under the age of 3, yeah, take them outside. Get them outside. Get them dirty. Get them interacting with animals. You know, it's incredibly unlikely it will be dangerous for them, and it's incredibly likely that it will have some benefit, even if it's just making them more entertained by the world, you know, and getting them away from a TV. Which I strongly recommend. Get them away from a TV. Not unless you work for a TV company, in which case you might want to keep them addicted to TV. Cigarettes. Fred.
Hi, Jack. Cows and pigs are fed, and other animals, chicken, are fed antibiotics. And
At epic levels.
Pardon?
At epic levels.
At epic levels. Could you comment about that?
So, yeah, the 85% of all antibiotics generated in this country are fed to animals. Most of them at subtherapeutic levels in order to increase the mass of the animal, and this makes them, fatter pig sells for more money. The other ones, the other reason we give them is because just the same as you have a large population of humans stuck in one place, like this, when you get a lot of animals and you put them together, the likelihood that if a disease is introduced into that population, that it spreads, is incredibly high. So in battery farms, where we get lots of animals and we squeeze them together in one place, you have to feed them antibiotics because the likelihood of a disease spreading is extremely high. So you've got to get away from two things. You've got to find a way to make animals put on more mass for the without feeding them antibiotics. And two, you've got to find a way of preventing them from having disease spread without giving them too many antibiotics. Because if those antibiotics get into the ecosystem, they could increase antibiotic resistance. They could lead to pathogens we call zoonotic pathogens that breed within those populations and reach out into human populations. We just don't need that extra risk.
So Are there any more effects, more direct effects from on our eating animals that have been?
Well, there's the potential that some of these antibiotics, this is great, you're setting me up, it's great. In a good way. There's a potential some of these antibiotics could get into the human food stream, and if they are, they could be influencing the development of obesity in children, for example. Subtherapeutic levels of antibiotics in children has been linked to an increase in obesity, just the same as it is with cows and pigs and chickens. So we are concerned about that, and there's also the potential that it could lead to a disrupted microbiome in our food stream, which could alter the development of our immune systems. Again, all of these are tenuous links.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fred.
The healthy populations and longevity, say, for example, Okinawa populations, is there any difference in the microbiome, or has it been studied?
So we're like a long-living population versus a short-living population, you know. Only in that Amerindian study from South America that I mentioned earlier, whereby you have a population living in a jungle who have a very short lifespan, of about 40 years on average, 38 years, but they have an incredibly diverse microbiome because they're living in a forest with no antibiotics, versus, you know, our population, which has almost a half the microbial diversity of their population. But, you know, bear in mind, our population has antibiotics given to us since birth. We also have a very undiverse food source. We usually eat the same kinds of foods regularly within a population. And we also live a very non-microbially rich life. You know, we live inside these buildings. So it's unsurprising that that difference occurs. But, you know, that's the wonderful thing about correlation. You know, we live longer. So, yeah, man, a low diverse microbiome must be a good thing, right? Let's kill off all the microbes in the Amerindians and they'll live for a longer time. Of course, that's not the case. We know that balance in our lifestyle versus our medical treatment versus our immune system versus our microbiome versus everything else that we do in our lives has to be taken into consideration.
When you do your microbiome testing and everything, do you check for candida? Because it seems in my practice, we have so many people with sugar cravings. And I mean, real serious, like it's crack for them.
Yeah.
And when you chase it down, it almost always you can find that they've had all the stuff you talked about, either C-section or antibiotics,
some dysbiosis,
anything. Yeah. Or they just plain ate a lot of sugar. And I found it a lot in teenagers and young adults. And it's really causing a huge problem.
I've got a couple of interesting anecdotes and some science behind that one. Number one, when you eat a lot of sugar, you know, a lot of sugary products or something that's high in glucose, fructose, whatever, it changes the microbiome in your mouth and in your gut, right? So it actually selects that ecosystem you create in yourself with lots of sugar creates a selective environment which selects for certain bacterial species. So you get a different microbiome in your mouth and your gut compared to normal. We know that for sure. And interestingly, the ones that it selects for in your mouth are the ones that cause caries, right? So, you know, tooth decay. Yeah. I mean, you know, the sugar causes tooth decay, but the sugar actually selects for a microbiome which is more active at decaying enamel and metabolically. So it's actually more profound than we thought it was. Number one, whenever I go to China and I eat only Chinese food, I never crave sugar. And I crave sugar all the time. I couldn't find me a candy bar in the store. I wanted a candy bar and I wanted M&M's only with green M&M's, but you didn't give me the green M&M bowl. It was in my writer. It's not cool. But I still went on. So whenever I go to China, I'm there for the 3 or 4 days and my microbiome somehow resets. And I say that sounds flippant, but something in my body changes and I no longer crave any sugar. Literally, my craving for chocolate and candy disappears. I don't have maybe a crack problem, like you suggest, but I definitely love sugar. Right? I find that very interesting every time I do it. Those are my anecdotes. We know, however, interestingly, that the microbial communities that are around sugar, they do have a direct interaction with the immune system. They have a very strong interaction with IgA in our gut, so immunoglobulin A, and they are almost like... They're not pathogenic, but they have the similar kind of strength of response that IgA does to a pathogen. And we think that might be having some kind of stimulatory effect on our nervous system, sending signals up to our brain and releasing a neurological stimulus in our brain which affects our behavior. So we think that it may be a positive feedback loop, like with the fatty foods, and we're trying to uncover that now. So it could be that, you know, once you're addicted to sugar, it's a positive feedback loop. You can't stop it because your microbes want more sugar, so they're sending signals to keep your sugar levels consumed. Okay. Thank you.
So I want to thank Jack, so please join me in thanking him for an extraordinary discussion.
Thank you.